Let's kick off. Welcome to the Oxford Centre for Tropical Forests seminar. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Frank Mayall, who is Professor of Tropical Paleoecology at Reading University. And Frank did his undergraduate at Reading, and then for his PhD he was at New Brunswick in Canada, and then at Royal Holloway in London, working on high latitude systems and late glacial interglacial transitions. But then, at a postdoc in Vesta, he started working in Amazonia and started doing work on the vegetation history of southwestern Amazonia. After that, he moved as a lecturer to Edinburgh University, where I overlapped with him for a while. And then, since 2013, he moved to Reading, where he's a professor of tropical paleoecology. And he works on the history of vegetation and archaeological and climate dynamics of many regions of southwest Amazonia in particular, which is the focus of his talk today. So, welcome, Frank.
Thanks very much indeed for inviting me, Linda. It's a real pleasure to be here. and thanks for the healthy turnout, because I know that the last week of term, many staff are dispersed. And at least they are ready, anyway. Okay, so without any further ado, this is the area that I'll be talking about, southwestern Amazonia, and in particular at Amazonian Bolivia. And I've been working there since the mid-1990s, and I haven't really ventured much beyond that part of South America, but not because I'm quite a parochial person, but simply because you've got this amazing juxtaposition of so many ecosystems, all sorts of stuff going on. We've got Amazon rainforest to the north. We've got seasonally flooded savannas over here. We've got semi-deciduous tropical dry forest. So all of this stuff going on. And it's got a steep climate gradient where it gets wetter further north. And lots of interesting things going on in terms of geomorphology. So when I started out with an ecological background, I was interested as to why we have these patterns and really what the long-term history actually is of these ecosystems, the extent to which they moved around, and trying to understand the reasons for this long-term dynamics. And I want to make clear at the outset that when I use the word I really mean we, and the research I'll be talking about really is a team effort from various PhD students, postdocs, and other collaborators over the years from a range of disciplines. So we can see a long list over here. And these are the main bodies that have been funding this research. So what's interesting for me at the moment is this really lively debate that's going on, especially over the last decade, about how we perceive Amazonia, the extent to which it really adheres to this paradigm of Amazonia as this ancient, sort of pristine wilderness, largely unchanging, you know, an iconic landscape, and one of the few untouched areas of the planet. And that was the accepted wisdom for many years, and that humans have been there for a long time, but only ever had a fairly small impact, a very small-scale, localized impact, very temporary, low population density, and explained by environmental reasons, so rather acidic, nutrient-poor soils, little protein. And that was the model, but there's increasing evidence over the last few years, which is hard to ignore, that raises the possibility that pre-Columbian indigenous peoples, so before the arrival of Europeans, had a far greater impact than previously assumed. And if we go to Acre State in Brazil, it's Brazilian Amazonia, just the other side of Bolivia, you get these sorts of images where these are clearly artificial features that we see. It's a bit of a silver lining, if you will, to deforestation. This cleared area, it's all rainforest. You take away the rainforest, you see these features, which shows that at least in this particular area, this forest can be no more than 500 years of secondary forest regrowth, which certainly challenges that assumption of these ancient pristine forests. And that we see little evidence of this now because the forest has grown back after depopulation by arrival of Europeans, European diseases, etc., with some people arguing for up to 95% depopulation. So I'm interested in this exciting debate where we still have many people who argue, especially among the tropical ecology community, that notwithstanding the psychological evidence, most of Amazonia really is effectively untouched and pristine, and the biodiversity that we see, the pattern of biodiversity, the processes going on, they are largely natural. Whereas on the other hand, we find some archaeologists and anthropologists who say there's no such thing as nature there, that it really is a human-created landscape. The biodiversity that we see, in fact, is a legacy of millennia of humans that are manipulating these forests, selecting those species which are more economically useful than others. So I'm interested as to where reality actually lies across this spectrum of opinion. Is there some mix in between? Is it one extreme or the other? So I'm interested, in my research group at Reading, in the interplay then, right, between natural drivers of ecosystem dynamics on the one hand, such as changes in climate over past millennia, the impact of fire, and also the impact of people, right? So how do these things, these different processes relate and intertwine with each other in the context of tropical ecosystems? So when I first started off in Amazonia, I was well and truly on the side of the debate that what we see is effectively natural, and that we can explain long-term dynamics purely in the context of natural drivers such as changes in climate. So that's where I began. And through serendipity, my first academic post at Leicester University, and I started working with collaboration with the University of Santa Cruz, sort of colleagues here in Noel Kent Mercado National Park in northeastern Bolivia. And we can see here at a glance that it falls across this sort of transition here between rainforest and dry forest. And you've got savanna there as well. So right at the southerlymost extent of rainforest. It's an interesting place. This was turned into a UNESCO World Heritage Site, I think around 1998 or 2000 or thereabouts. You've got this big meseta that Colonel Fawcett visited here. There's a Hollywood movie, Brad Pitt, out about this, I think, at the moment. Linda went to see it recently. Lots of debate about whether or not this was the inspiration for Arthur Conan Doyle's novel The Lost World, or if it was the Venezuelan Tipuis, but anyway, so I digress. But it's a really magical place. If you haven't had a chance, if you ever get the opportunity to go there, I'd highly recommend it. Here's a Landsat image of it. All different kinds of ecosystems, so very rich in terms of habitat diversity, beta diversity. The boundary of the park is shown here, and here we're grading now from rainforests up here into these dry forests, and this is the meseta, this table mountain covered in edaphic savanna. So we've got these two large lakes over here within the rainforest, Laguna Bella Vista and then Laguna Chaplin, about 100 kilometers apart. And so we caught those with the hope that we can try and reconstruct its long-term history and see what was going on. And the key tool that we use in my lab is analysis of fossil pollen that we find preserved in these lake sediments or peat bogs. And this provides us with a means of reconstructing vegetation change over past centuries and thousands of years. So those of you who are not familiar with this technique, you can see a range of different pollen types here, and effectively a fingerprint of the plant allows us to actually recognize what the plant was. It's normally at family level or genus level, and on occasion we can get the species, but normally that's a sort of taxonomic resolution. And what we've learned by looking at these 50,000 60-year fossil pollen records is that we've had this late Holocene expansion southwards of humid evergreen rainforest. Starting earlier here, starting about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, and then surrounding the catchment by 2,000 years ago up here, and by about 650 years ago at Laguna Chaplin, and here's a present-day ecozone. So we've had this progressive expansion southwards, and this now is the southernmost extent of humid rainforest over at least the last 50,000 years. So why was there this rainforest expansion? Well, luckily, we have a very good paleoclimatic record perched up on top of the Andes, Lake Titicaca, here at about 12,000 feet. And although it's much higher than these sites, most of its rainfall actually comes from Amazonia. So we can think of this as a rain gorge for this part of the Amazon basin. And Lake Titicaca has been fluctuating in terms of lake level, and we know from a bunch of different sorts of evidence, seismic data and diatoms and geochemistry, that between 3,000 and 8,000 years ago it was much lower, with this big slow stand centered around 6,000 years ago, and about 90 or 100 meters lower than it is now, which is a huge decrease. Here we've got the record. This is time going back through the Holocene, and here we've got the lake level reconstruction. And other sites, Sahama Mountain, this is an ice cap that's nearby. We've got increase in dust, which signifies drier conditions around the same time. So conditions were drier then in the mid-Holocene. Since then, they've been getting wetter. And the timing of this is in sync with the changes in austral summer insolation, with a relatively less austral summer insolation 6,000 years ago and increasing toward the present. And this is in line with astronomical forcing according to the 20,000 year precession orbital cycle. And what insolation does is that strengthens or weakens the South American summer monsoon. So at the present, it's at its strongest through the Holocene. 6,000 years ago, it was relatively weaker. And therefore, this makes sense in terms of an explanation or mechanism for that rainforest expansion, that it's being expanding southwards as the monsoon has been strengthening through the Holocene. So this fits in quite nicely then with this climate driver. But since that work, I've been getting more and more interested in the prospect that people have also had a significant impact upon these ecosystems. And why did I come to this realization? Well, because of the increase in archaeological information that's been published over the last decade especially, which is increasingly hard to ignore. So I showed you these sorts of images where we've got rainforest that's been deforested that is revealing this evidence of pre-Columbian anthropogenic impact. Areas look like football pitches. All of these are cattle pasture now, which until the late 1970s was covered by humid rainforest. In parts of Bolivia, the Llanos de Mojos seasonally flooded savannas, you've got these causeways straight as an arrow for several kilometers that are linking these forest islands. You've got these raised fields which were built in areas which are very sparsely populated now. So this has really sort of stimulated my interest in the linkages then between human land use and climate change. So what I've tried to do is to work with archaeologists and to see if we can integrate our approaches to see what's going on. And in the past, in Amazonia, we've been very separate communities. The archaeologists there, we've got very little understanding what paleoecologists like myself do and vice versa. The questions up until then that I was asking were about climate drivers. So I was looking at very big lakes with a large regional catchment that can pick up large-scale drivers such as changes in climate. These big, broad-scale reconstructions are no use for trying to match what's going on at local scales where the archaeology is. So we're talking cross-purposes. So to try and understand how people fit into the story, we've now been trying to look for very small lakes that have a local scale catchment that can map on to the local scale catchment and story coming from archaeology. So here we've got this pre-Columbian raised fields on the one hand over here. We've got a small lake in the Gallery Forest, and they are physically close together. That provides us with the opportunity of integrating these different lines of evidence. So the beauty of paleoecology is that it gives us a nice continuous time series, which is often difficult to get from archaeological data, which by the nature of the evidence is often very discontinuous, and allows us to therefore find evidence in our sediment core of a human occupation, such as cultivation, maize for example, looking at pollen, looking at charcoal, an index of burning, and then integrating that with archaeobotanical evidence from these features, raised fields in this case, phytoliths, which in contrast to pollen are well preserved within soils. You don't find pollen there because it's oxidized away. That's why paleoecology, you need to go where the lakes are, where you've got pollen well preserved. And we can tie this with the archaeological information itself, starch grains and phytoliths within the ceramics, plant processing tools. We know what they're actually processing for food. So we can ask questions about what kind of diet they had, what crops they were cultivating, and what the environmental context was of their occupation and environmental impact as well. So those sorts of questions that we're looking at, and the working hypothesis was that back in the early Holocene, so we know that we had people in Amazonia since about 12,000 years ago, population has been increasing since then, so we can therefore reasonably assume there's increasing impact of people upon these ecosystems, an increasing use of fire, an increase in terms of forest management, selecting economically useful species over others. The palms, in particular, are especially important for people, and other fruit trees, maize and other crops, manioc, all of these things. So hopefully we can pick up this evidence of increasing human land use. And then along come Europeans, 95% depopulation or thereabouts, and then we've got forest recovery. Not necessarily back to what it was, there may well still be a large legacy of millennia of human impact within the forests we see now. So the idea is to look for this sort of picture potentially. So an area that I'll be talking about now is called the Llanos de Mojos, this big yellow splodge over here, seasonally flooded savanna. It's not savanna because it's too dry for there to be rainforest. It's savanna for hydrological and edaphic reasons. It's underwater for half the year, so it's flooded, and then it dries out to almost like concrete in the dry seasons. So you've got these clays that dry out. So these edaphic conditions are not very good for trees, and that's why it's savanna. And you can see that it's completely circled by forest. So let's have a look at this. This is a blow up here. I'll be talking about these three different areas. First of all, taking you to where these pre-Columbian raised fields have been discovered up in the northwest, and then to these large habitation mounds, and then these ring ditches over here. So you can see it's this forest savanna mosaic. You've got forest that's found on slightly higher elevation on the River Leves, and where you've got paleo rivers over here. This is the westernmost part of the pre-Cambrian shield, these ancient rocks. So these are higher elevation, that's why you have forest. All this stuff here is open, seasonally flooded savanna. So, going to the raised fields, this is a very sparsely populated area now, one of the poorest parts of South America. Most people think soils are no good for anything except for cattle ranching, and that's mainly what it's used for now. And yet, from the 1950s, when William Denovan first took some of the earliest commercial flights, he found all of these huge areas of pre-Columbian raised field. And clearly these are not natural features, they can only be explained by people. So it's a very it's a very marginal habitat. So it's seasonally flooded, lots of flooding. This is Trinidad a few years ago. Lots of issues. And you can see that you've got forest that is now expanding into these savannas by virtue of these raised fields. They're raised up above the flood level. So people inadvertently have been creating this terra firma landscape. You take away the people, and you've got forest that's encroaching upon it. That we can see these linear lines of forest where it's expanding into these areas. This has inspired NGOs like Oxfam to set up experimental raised field plots just outside of Trinidad, the provincial capital. Mixed success, and they're guessing what they were used for. So they've been building these features, and yes, there is increase in the yield of these crops, but they're having to bring in water, so they're building these close to oxbow lakes. They haven't found a way to maintain water through the dry season. They're having so they haven't really taken off. It's a mixed success, to be polite, really. Okay. But it's a big question for us as paleontologists and archaeologists is to find out what they were using these for in pre-Columbian times, what crops were being used and actually grown. And so using this interdisciplinary approach, we're trying to get to these sorts of questions. So archaeological information coming up here, ceramics. We're digging into the raised fields. There's Jose Iriarte, my colleague at Exeter University, I think was up here giving a talk a year or so ago, looking at the phytoliths. And with paleoecology, we've got these lakes near the rivers that can tell us about the Gallery Forest, but also, because these are quite close to the raised fields, they can tell us what was grown on the raised fields and give us this continuous time series, as I said. So we can recognize maize pollen, we can recognize maize phytoliths, and we can see maize actually within the archaeology as well. So we can tie these things together. Maize is an interesting finding because it's quite a fussy plant. It actually needs to have fairly nutrient-rich soils. And yet most people consider these soils to be no good now for anything except for cattle ranching. So you can see why these raised fields were not even recognized until people started flying over them, because they're quite subtle from the ground. You're walking over them and you barely realize. But, you know, you've had over 500 years of these things eroding away, so it's unsurprising that they're quite subtle. But from the air and from Google Earth, you can see them very clearly, as I've shown you. So this is Jose here, excavating through these. At the same time, we're busy coring those oxbow lakes nearby. This is Bronwyn Whitney, my former postdoc and PhD student, who is now a member of staff up in Northumbria. Okay, so what did we find out then by tying together these different lines of evidence? So this is the paleoecology here. I won't take you through all the species, but the take-home message is that we've got a time series going from the present day all the way back to 800 years AD, so about 1200 years. Present day, we've got the Gallery Forest. So let's see what has been going on here. First of all, we find evidence of maize from the pollen, and we find lots of charcoal, but no forest. So they had cut down this Gallery Forest, and they were cultivating, so we think, the River Leves, but the raised fields nearby as well. We've got burning, that's unsurprising. People think where you've got people, you've got fire, so nothing surprising there. But as I said, it's intriguing that we've got maize that's being grown given that nowadays the staple for indigenous peoples is manioc and sweet potato. Maize is rather rarely grown. You find it along the Vazir region where you've got lots of mineral-rich material being brought in. Then we get a change in land use, not when Europeans arrive, actually before that. So about 1300 AD, maize in fact disappears and we get sweet potato coming in. And we have a massive decrease in charcoal. So no burning anymore. Along come Europeans with depopulation, and you've got the Galloway Forest now bouncing back. So you've got forest pollen assemblages here. But there's still sweet potato that's being grown up through here. Inga as well. I'm not quite sure what that means. Maybe that speaks to forest management. Not quite sure. But interesting story. So this is quite a complicated picture that changes the assumptions of the simple picture of people and fire, along come Europeans and everything goes to pot. So we've got land use change that both precedes European arrival and postdates it. So a complex story that's emerging here. We have got staple crops, maize and or sweet potato. Yeah, so changing through time in the same place. Soil fertilization, maybe. Maybe they were mulching and using that to fertilize the raised fields, using the mulch, things like water hyacinth growing in the ditches in between the raised fields, possibly. Use of fire, yes and no. At times they were burning, at other times they appeared to have been suppressing fire. Okay, so this is quite a complex picture that we're picking up here. Let's take a move further south. So what's intriguing, right, is that these pre-Columbian cultures are quite sort of different. The Amistomachos, you can see here about the size of England, raised fields are concentrated on the western side of the Mamore River, over here, and up here where I've been talking about. Down here, they're largely absent. In the southern Yamasomachos, you've got huge habitation mounds. Towards the northeast, you've got the ring ditches and causeways. So these are spatially discrete or distinct. So let's take you to the southern Yamasomachos here, large habitation mounds. Again, you've got a forest savanna mosaic. But for different reasons, here we've got forest that lines the rivers and forest away from the rivers. But if you take a closer look at the geomorphology, these forests line paleo rivers. So these are ancient river levees. The river has since changed its course, but the geomorphology has left an imprint with raised topography that allows a forest that grows. So again, we've got forests on the slightly elevated areas where it's not flooded, or at least not flooded so much or frequently. What's intriguing is that you find these large mounds which are associated with the forest, right? With the rivers, either present-day rivers or paleo rivers. These are monumental in size. They look entirely natural, except that when you get archaeologists such as Heiko Prümers from Germany excavating through these, you find ceramics all the way through. They probably started off as levees, but they've been building up upon them. Okay. Around them we often have ditches or moats. We might have artificial ponds nearby. These are connected through causeways with other mounds. A really complex and sophisticated network that was going on. And the finding that they were used for habitation but also burial as well. Skeletons here, sophisticated burials, fancy earrings here, nice jaguar tooth necklaces. So this speaks to somebody of importance, and so this speaks to social stratification All right, lots of goods of importance associated with that burial. The whole mound network speaks to social organization, hierarchical societies, which are very different from the egalitarian slash and burn shifting agricultural societies we have now. A million miles away from that, in an area which is very sparsely populated now. Sophisticated ceramics that we see here. Archaeologists have had artistic impressions of what was going on the landscape, and have been assuming or arguing that they were basically torching the landscape, lots of fire, they were cutting down the Galilee forest and creating this entirely human-built environment. The physical environment clearly is human-built, and that's been demonstrated from this landscape archaeology with the causeways and these mounds, the ceramics, etc. But a question mark is what the vegetation was doing, the scale of impact, and that's what we set out to try and answer. Nature has been kind to us. We've got lots of lakes in this region, allowing us to do paleoecology. But not always small lakes. This is a very big lake, giving us a very big regionally integrated catchment of vegetation, which isn't ideal for knowing what's going on at a particular archaeological site, but I'll come to that in a second. This is where those mounds are located. Okay. Just to throw this in to show they're quite exciting places to get to. It's logistically quite challenging. Sometimes we can't use our vehicles. Seasonally flooded landscapes often don't lend themselves to access, even in the dry season. So sometimes having to use horseback here. Sometimes it can be nice and cooperative, and other times not. So we can see. Okay, just using simple coring platforms. This is the pollen record that my postdoc at the time produced from that lake, extending back to about 400 AD, which is the length of the archaeological record, coincidentally. Charcoal goes a bit further back, well, the pollen goes back to about here, and nothing's happening. It's a very, very boring record. Okay, well, that's a dud site, let's throw that away, but wait a minute, this actually is informative, even though there's nothing going on. The fact that nothing is going on, even though there is with the archaeology, I think is important. This is a large lake, so it gives us a regional picture of what's going on. It tells me that the forest savanna mosaic has stayed constant since 400 AD. You've got all these habitation mounds, over 200 of them, and yet the amount of forest has stayed constant. So there cannot have been clear-cutting all of this forest. If there had been, you would pick that up in the pollen record. But there is evidence of maize and all the way through. So although it's giving us a regional story, the core site is close to the shore that picks up maize, because maize pollen is not transported very far. So ironically, this is telling us about what's going on regionally and also locally. So we've got maize that's been grown all the way back through here, but no raised fields. Lots of charcoal, where there's no charcoal now. Lots of charcoal, peak charcoal, and the chronology coincides with the archaeology. What's intriguing is that, so no large-scale deforestation. If they weren't cutting down the forest and burning the forest, what were they actually burning? Maybe they were instead burning the open savanna. What's intriguing is that the charcoal disappears before European contact, which actually ties in with the archaeology. This culture appears to have disappeared about 1400 AD, about a century before Europeans arrived, which begs another question that we don't have the answers to yet, but it does raise a possibility as maybe climate or other reasons that we don't yet know. So pre-European collapse of the society. No change in forests of Savanna mosaic. So if there was deforestation, which there must be, you would think, to build these features in the first place, it can only have been fairly localized, because otherwise we would have seen that being represented in the pollen data. So this is a lovely artistic impression. Unfortunately, it's not borne out by the paleontological evidence. Okay. All right. So let's take you to the third of these regions in the Anostomochos, over here. This is right on the edge of the Precambrian Shield. So this is the edge of the Anostomochos, season-flooded savannas here. This is all terra firma, upland rainforest. Yeah, this is non-flooded. And the study area is right at the margin. And this is the Itenes region. These are black water rivers or clear water. Let me see there. And this is zooming in. This is the San Martin River over here that marks this geomorphological divide. Okay, a small village here called Bella Vista. And what we have, as I said, this terra firma rainforest to the north. And to the south, we've got the seasonally flooded savanna of the Llanos de Mochos Basin. Forest islands here as well, but very different from those I've shown you before. These are forest islands not because these are river levees or anything like that. These are outcrops of the Brazilian Shield. All right, these are outcrops of the shield, so up above the flood level, that's why you have rainforest. Got savanna in between because it's flooded. So what I want to talk about are these two lakes. This huge lake here, about 4 or 5 kilometers in diameter, Oricare, and this small oxbow over here called Laguna La Granja. And Oricare, because of its large size, gives us a large regional pollen catchment. The surface pollen assemblage is not telling us about savanna. It's dominated by rainforest pollen, telling us that this is telling us what's going on over here. Okay? It's capturing all of this pollen. This, on the other hand, is a very small lake that's telling us what's going on at this local scale. So we've got these nested sites. Laguna Ricaray giving us this regional large-scale picture of what's happening, and nested within that, we've got local scale. The archaeologist, Heiko Prumers, from the German Archaeological Institute and his colleagues have been doing LIDAR throughout this region here. This is that village, Bella Vista. This is all the shield area here. And there are over 20 of these ring ditches that we can see here, that superimposing this EDM. This is all that savanna region over here. This is the shield. All of this is hidden underneath this rainforest. You can't see any of this. So, what's going on? The question that we were asking ourselves was, were people cutting down rainforests to build these ring ditches? And if so, that implies a huge amount of labor and maybe therefore a very big population density. Or maybe they took advantage of a naturally open savanna landscape when the climate back then was too dry to support rainforest, as we learned from our sites in Noel Kempf Mercado National Park, a bit further south. This is a ring ditch here, right next to an oxbow, Laguna La Granja, as I showed you. So nature, again, being kind to us, allowing us to integrate the paleoecology with the archaeology. This is not savanna here, just to explain. This is just recent deforestation for agriculture, right, in just the last few centuries or so. All right, so this should all be rainforest. So were these features built in savanna? taking advantage of a naturally open landscape, which would be much easier than having to cut down all the forest. These pictures can be quite deep, 3 meters. Here's John Carson, my postdoc, who worked on this lake. He's not a short guy, but this is a present day ground level, just showing you how deep these ditches are. Right, 3 meters, up to 5 meters in some cases. So a huge amount of labour at constructing these features. So let's go to that very big lake with that regional picture of what's going on, Laguna Orikere, a 6,000 year record. Savannah, through most of that time, 6,000 years up until 2,000 years ago, we have a savannah pollen signal, lots of charcoal, no surprise, savannah burns much more than rainforest, so it's telling us about the biome. And then 2,000 years ago, rainforest expanding in, a decrease in charcoal, rainforest is less flammable. This is the same picture we've had from Noel Kemp and Mikado National Park, the sites I showed you. Rainforest expansion caused by climate. It's in tune with that. So that is the same story we've heard from these sites, so nothing unusual there. It ties in with Lake Titicaca. Let's go to that oxbow, right, which is nested within that catchment, but very local scale picture. As I've shown you, lots of earthworks around here, these ring ditches. Here's the site. Pollen record, very different. 6,000 year record, which is quite amazing from an oxbow lake. But charcoal picture, vegetation is very different. Charcoal is absent through most of this record. It only appears here. This is because the charcoal, this is telling us what's going on locally. Charcoal appears where you have people. You've got maize coming through here. Charcoal through here. Peak charcoal correlates with the chronology of the ring ditch from the archaeology. So this meshes absolutely perfectly with the archaeological story. And this charcoal pattern is nothing to do with what's going on with the vegetation picture. It's telling us about what people are doing. The big lake I showed you showed rainforest expansion 2,000 years ago, but savanna or open ground continues here until only 500 years ago. So we think that people have been keeping this rainforest expansion at bay, at a local scale. We only see forests coming in 1,500 years later, once Europeans arrive, and then the indigenous people disappear through European disease, and you've got forest finally that's filling up these gaps. Okay, so we think therefore they took advantage of an open landscape, they kept it open, and they built these features within that. Only once people disappear have you then got forest that is growing over them. Now finally I want to finish up by taking you to the state of Acre, a bit further north, just the other side of Bolivia, where most of these ring ditches or geoglyphs have been discovered. This is the core, if you like, the epicenter of these huge geometric earthworks. And the mind boggles at these features. They're not just circles, but squares or rectangles. Sometimes you've got double ditches. Sometimes these are regular shapes. Sometimes you've got a moat that's outside the mound, which makes sense for defense. Sometimes the moat is on the inside. Go figure that, if it's for defense. So sometimes you've got two. So there's no obvious suggestion that they were used for defense. Nobody really knows why they were built. Alcide Ranzi, he first discovered these in the late 1970s. And then we see them everywhere now with Google Earth. Over 400 of these have been discovered in only 13,000 square kilometers, just the eastern part of the state of Acre, and only discovered because it's been deforested. And significant features, just look at the size of this ditch. This is after 500 years of infill. The original depth was about 5 meters. So think of 400 Avebury's. You know, we're used to thinking of the UK as an anthropogenic landscape. Most people don't consider that Amazonia, in certain areas, was also anthropogenic. So here we see all of them. Yeah, you take away the forest and they're springing up everywhere. So the question that we asked was, what scale of deforestation was associated with their construction? Was it just small clearings in the rainforest? You know, we asked the same questions as we asked for Bolivia. Or, so did they clear cut the entire region? They completely devastated the forest, which has since bounced back. Or maybe, as we discovered before, they took advantage of a naturally open savanna landscape. And that's got huge implications, as I said, for the labour involved in constructing these things. You'd spend your entire life cutting down trees if it actually was completely covered by rainforest. Okay, so this is work with colleagues at Exeter, who's at Iriarte's group, where so the postdoc at the time, PhD at the time, Jenny Watlin, who's now in Sao Paulo. This vegetation is really quite distinct. It's a real mosaic that we see there now. We've got humid rainforest, but we've also got palm-dominated forest, and critically, we've got this bamboo forest. Huge areas of bamboo, and big question mark for many years as to whether that's a natural phenomenon, is it a legacy of pre-Columbian people, yeah, that's coming into areas that were previously forested, previously opened up, or what? So Chris McMichael has been doing work on that. So this coincides with the geoglyph region. Is that an accident or not? So we set out to look at the archaeology, working with archaeologists there, doing paleoecology, and looking at these transects of soil pits to look at the phytoliths. Most of these are located in the interfluves, which is bad for paleoecology because there are no lakes there. So in contrast to Bolivia, you've got very, very few lakes. The only lakes you find are oxbows, which are small. It tells us what's going on locally, but it tells us nothing what's going on away from the river, which is a problem. So that's why we've been giving much more emphasis to the soil pit work here. So what we did was to construct this transect of soil pits radiating out from the archaeology. These are the geoglyphs here. And we've got this transect going out over 8 kilometres to see if we can pick out the scale of deforestation. Was it just a local opening or was it much bigger? And we should be able to pick that out with this transect. So that was the strategy behind it. Here's Jenny here, just poking her head out of the soil pit. And this is what she published in the journal PNAS in February this year. I don't need to see all of this, but what's going on, basically, the brown is forest. Each of these 6 panels is each of these pits. Yeah, it goes back about 5,000 or 6,000 years. These soil pits go back about 1.4 meters in depth. We've got bamboo, the orange, that goes all the way back 6,000 years uninterrupted. So we think that bamboo is a natural phenomenon. But we've got palm that is also present and is increasing and decreasing, and Jenny is arguing that it's increasing where you've got the geoglyphs, and roughly when you've got them being built, and the palm is not doing what you would expect it to be doing if it was just an ecological story. And so this appears to be evidence of humans playing around with the composition of these forests. The chronology is a bit over the place, but roughly we do have a time series going back about 6,000 years. But the key take-home message is, irrespective of the composition, it's been forested throughout that 6,000 years, along the entire 8-kilometer transect. We don't find in any of these pits any evidence of opening up of the forest, whether that's savanna whether that's clear cutting. If they were opening it up, it was for a very short period. So forest story all the way through, which is in contrast to what we found in Bolivia, showing that the climate was never dry enough to cause that biome turnover. It was forest all the way through. So, what can we learn from this? The simplistic model of virgin versus domesticated Amazon, I think it's too simplistic. It's much more going on. It's much more complicated in terms of when we had land use change and the kind of land use. Clearly, areas now thought unproductive were heavily utilized in the past by crops that we tend to think of being very fussy in terms of nutrients. We have climate as part of this story. So it's both people and climate and ecosystems with these interactions. And hopefully I've illustrated that we can only get to grips with some of these questions using an interdisciplinary approach. So implications, just want to end up here, and really I'm asking these for insights from the audience as your specialty is working with forests. Conservation policy. It begs the question, I think, whether it's necessarily always right to exclude all forms of human land use, given that we've got a strong legacy of humans that are interacting with these ecosystems. Of course, the question is what kind of land use should be allowed. And I think it does speak to greater resilience of these forests than is often assumed. We often hear the word fragility being bandied about for rainforest, for no apparent reason. Biogeochemical cycling with the Advinders group work. Of course, you correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that is a leading hypothesis for the increase in biomass over the last several decades of CO2 fertilization. But this does beg the question whether or not maybe some of this might be a legacy of forests recovering from this. Is there still some secondary succession maybe that's going on, forests maybe bouncing back, given that a tree may live for over 600 years? So, thank you very much indeed for your time, and I welcome any questions you might have.